The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Pagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series, but the QA, that's the important part because we like to make this an interactive conversation. We like to make this a back and forth, an exchange. It's why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday. We've got a whole week of news. We've actually got some pretty heavy politics, tech and politics, reshaping the perception of online speech and the First Amendment. And we got to dig into that just a little bit. Just got to cover it. But that's how we know. We've kind of settled our feelings. We've given it some time. It's not just, I read a headline and I got outraged. We're going to share some back and forth here. I'm already seeing an incredible group. Gunny Six, I believe this is the first time we've had chat from Gunny Six. Nice. Made it. Dave Burns, always with love. I'm here to speak for yourself. I'm here to derail your show. Aditya No with a Guten Tag. JMan50, has anyone been watching Queen Elizabeth's funeral? We had it on the TV. Like I said last week and on Best of Our Week, for all of the people in the UK and the sort of collected Commonwealth where there's an aristocracy and a royal family, I can't lend a lot to that perspective. I mean, I'm an American, and I'm kind of a knuckle-dragging American when it comes to sort of that world decorum. But this is also, I mean, my wife and I have been fascinated by this our entire lives. We've never seen this exchange of figurehead in a position like this. So, I mean, it's just fascinating to see, and it's been really interesting to watch the different perspectives of people as this has happened. For me, this is a historical event, and I'll be very interested to see, sort of following up on this, what this means for this role. I mean, obviously the royal family doesn't exhibit the same kind of direct political power in this modern age, but I still think it's fascinating what they represent to the people of the UK. So very, very interesting. Very interesting to follow. But yes, I'm seeing J-Man, Dave Burns, Gunny Six, Ron Guido, Twin Folk Tech, Farhan. We've got so much to chat about. Would just like to start off and say, I hope everyone had a lovely weekend. I hope you had some time off. I was mostly working this weekend. I'm still so far behind on review stuff. I've got lots of things coming up and a couple fun embargoes that hopefully will start clearing over the next week. But it's just like all of that kind of gets front loaded. When I got to go to an industry mixer, it was sort of like a little Hollywood party. The folks at Odyssey invited me down out to Toluca Lake, and apparently they've got this new pair of mixing cans. The headphones are gorgeous. They're like $1,700 planar magnetic Pro Series cans. Real nice. I've been a longtime fan of what Odyssey does, and there's a premium on those products, but like, man, there's a unique sound there that I really appreciate that they're trying to capture. When that is just a part of the week that I've got to fly by and throw up on Instagram and then get on to the next part of the things, I know I'm swamped. That's something that in the past would have been like an entire week of production for me to craft this video and talk about the event. And then you're like, I just need to hit this thing. I held these cans. I listened to them. Thought they were cool. Okay, cool. I got to move on. I know I'm getting overworked. So, yeah, it's been a lot. There's some really cool tech. And to kind of go along with that, I feel like one of the conversations that we continuously check in on, it really seems like I can't finish a review of a product without at least touching on the state of media, SEO, social media, kind of the bandwagon effect of popularity. And there are a few products that kind of engender that discussion better than the iPhone. So definitely for the second half of the podcast, the Gadget Block, we've got to spend some time kind of digging into some of the reviews and reactions to the iPhone 14 and the 14 Pro. I'm not going to be reviewing them. I'm still holding to this kind of Apple embargo until I see some other business practices change. It's not anything reflective of the products themselves, and I have no ill will towards people that are in the Apple ecosystem that want to buy new gear and they want to support that company. But for my personal side of this, I cannot spend money or promote products that I feel are being produced in this fashion, and with the less than ideal commitments to Apple for their own customers. So I'll be continuing that embargo. That means I stopped riding the Apple train at the iPhone SE 2020. This is my experience with iOS 16 so far. And I do have some thoughts because I don't feel bad holding up an iPhone SE 2020 in the conversation that I'm trying to have, keeping gadgets around longer, getting your bang for buck, really getting the most use out of them. I have my Apple Watch Series 4 here on the charger. Battery life has not been great, but it's all fully updated to match my iPhone SE 2020. So, why don't we dig into some housekeeping? Why don't we start chewing through that, and we can kind of get into the show proper. It was a real good week. Last week was a really fun week, even for being so far behind on a bunch of review products. But from traveling to visit some family to coming back home to a busted AC, which took days to fix in 105 degree heat, I actually blew a UPS. That's how scary hot it was getting in this office full of other batteries and stuff. So my wife and I are very seriously reworking. It's one of the things that's taking time is like, we've got power generators. We need to have cooling fans. I need to treat this a little bit more like a production studio. I've invested in new fire extinguishers. I mean, like the stuff gets real serious. And it's another thing why I've been increasingly trying to get rid of older review phones. Like, I've just got a bunch of batteries sitting over there on that bookshelf, and I don't want anything bad to happen. We own this place. So just that's been taking up extra time that I would normally just be like cranking out videos. So last week on, or excuse me, I should do this like TV promo. Last week on SomeGadgetGuy.com. Just throw this into some screen share. And one of the major videos, I was really stoked to get some time to play with this, the YouPerfect X Mini Laptop Dock. The folks at YouPerfect I've been cranking out some fantastic portable display gear. I've been a big fan. The U-Perfect X, kind of right neck and neck with the Next Dock. They have a 4K monitor. They've got, this is their newest fold and flip. This is an 11.6-inch display, which is even just a little bit smaller in overall footprint than my Microsoft Surface Laptop Go 2. You know, the little 12-inch student Microsoft Surface. This U-Perfect X has been a trick. So I would normally be holding it up even now just to say like, oh, look, and I've got it. But I've actually packed it up because I want to ship it over to a buddy of mine. Hopefully he can spend a little time with it and also kind of double dip on a review. I still feel like portable displays are the unsung heroes. They're the most underrated accessories that you can buy for your gadgets. And yet they're some of the most versatile, some of the best bang for buck, expanding on the use of everything that you own. Plug them into a tablet, plug them into a phone, to a game console, a Nintendo Switch, a Steam Deck, another laptop. So even though it looks a little silly to have a laptop dock with a keyboard and a mouse, you can flip it into tent mode and plug it into another laptop and have dual display in one of the best ways to carry a portable monitor, because it sort of protects itself. Like, the case of the laptop dock is also the cover for the display. So there's just so many of these things I feel are completely undersung. And when someone points out, oh, I could buy a Chromebook. Yeah, you can buy a cheap Chromebook, and it's going to be way less powerful than your phone, and it's only going to get a couple years of software updates. Then you've got to look at putting Linux on an underpowered piece of hardware, and you can't use it with anything else. Like, you can't plug a camera into it, you can't plug a tablet into it, you can't use it as a portable monitor or another display. So I don't feel the bang for buck really turns out to be a win for having another full, discrete, cheap computer. Cheap computers are cheap. I don't mind giving a cheap Chromebook to a student because we're pretty sure a young student's going to wreck that Chromebook. If you're a grown-up and you like to get more bang for buck out of your other gadgets, I think a laptop dock, which will last several generations of other product. I still have my second gen Next Dock. Like, the batteries are still doing great. I still use it because it was the metal body Next Dock. It feels nicer. It looks nicer. It's a really well-built piece of hardware. Still cooking. I mean, that thing's getting on 3 years now, maybe four. I'm super old. So that, I feel like those types of videos, I need to highlight them a bit more. The mission is always, can you get more use out of your products? And another way that we can do that is also sprucing up our audio. So another major review, the Eco ITX01. This is a little USB-C laptop hub, and it's got built-in high-res audio. This is another video I was really stoked to kind of put this all together and get them working on it. Getting out of screen share. Again, just a little metal body. I mean, a really nicely built metal body USB-C hub. Very fast data transfer rates. The card reader is super slow. But on the end of the hub, instead of having like an Ethernet port, which I kind of wish it had an Ethernet port too, we have 3.5 and 4.4 millimeter headphone jacks. And it's a pretty good little DAC built into this. It's not going to take the place of like a THX Onyx, you know, a $200 standalone dongle DAC, but it's probably a serious step up over most of the headphone jacks on laptops, and it's at a pretty reasonable price. Speaking of reasonable prices, I was also really excited. Here, I'll screen share this first. One more sent over the Sonoflow. The Sonoflow Bluetooth ANC headphones, retail $99.99. They're currently on sale for $20 off. So if you catch my video or if you go to Amazon, I've got links for both the One More store and the... oh, these are still on. I should probably turn them off. So I have links for both, and you can pick them up either directly from One More or from Amazon. But you know, at $20 off or $80, these are maybe one of my top recommendations for a good travel headphone. Very well built, minimum creaky headband. Like, I think they're quieter than my Sony XM4s. The XM5s are built a little bit nicer, but over my XM4s, where sometimes I can get them kind of creaking a bit if I'm just flexing the muscles in my skull, there is a bit of that creak on these. They are noticeably quieter than headphones that cost twice as much. Great ANC on tap, really good sound quality, LDAC connectivity, and the One More companion app has improved tremendously. Full review, full video, but if you want to do some shopping, you're looking for a good, inexpensive travel headset, this is going toe-to-toe with some of the new Soundcore gear. And really, I just want people to get more specific on the kind of tuning they like. You know, there are reasons why I might lean Soundcore. There are reasons why I might lean One More. For myself personally, I kind of like the One More tuning a bit better than the Soundcore tuning. Totally subjective, but now we've got a competitor in that $80 to $100 price tier, which is just stunning. One More has done a really good job of packaging their nicer Bluetooth audio gear this year. And when you want incredible battery life, great ANC, very good sound quality, good tweaking options to customize the sound, man, we're flush for great options right now. It's really solid. And then lastly, I wrote another cranky editorial, and increasingly I kind of like this vibe. Instead of trying to turn everything into a talking head video, I pay for this blog. I'm paying for this web hosting. I am not happy with the way that YouTube sort of promotes videos and stuff. Increasingly, I've been driving more audience to my web zone to rip off Red Letter Media. So at somegadgetguide.com, you're probably thinking about smartphone camera night modes all wrong. A little image there doing night mode wrong. And just wanted to kind of break down, again, a few more of these like completely ignorant hot takes that I still get on my videos. I know a lot of people are like on both sides of this spectrum, like the more camera focused people and the more smartphone focused people keep doing this. Oh, but Juan, who's really complaining? And you're like, there are so many idiots on the internet. Like, they're really bad at this and they're clogging up comments. And just because you're not seeking out this kind of information, it doesn't mean that people with bad hot takes on new camera tech aren't influencing the opinions of other people who are less experienced with it. I actually got blocked by a photographer that I used to really respect on Twitter, and he just kept like picking at all of these arguments, and then like, oh, but iPhones are the best, and if mom and pop need to spend $800 on an iPhone, well, then that's the right price. You can't tell them that that's the wrong price. And you're like, you can't see what an intense consumer harm it is to tell like grandma and grandpa to achieve their basic point and shoot photography that $800 is normal. And this is a person who used to take like some of the most amazing, I learned so much from this guy. Shooting wildlife photography. Like, he's got this series of like shooting eagles, and it's amazing. And he's old now, and he's becoming like a photography boomer guy. And when it's like he also runs like an iPhone photography like side conversation, and he treats phones like phones. So his whole commentary is still built on this, like, well, I guess if you have nothing but garbage in your pocket, then the best camera is the garbage that you have with you. And he shoots a phone like it's a phone. But he's also trying to, like, front this, like, toy photography. I don't know. So it's a long story. It's a long thing. But again, at that same time, it's like, you've got these misconceptions. You're reinforcing these misconceptions. Other people are turning to you as, like, an educational resource, and you're giving them bad data. Plus, you're years out of date. So I'm trying to bring up these counterpoints, like there's the Pixel, or you could go with the Galaxy A series if you want point and shoot. And you're like, I tried an Android once and it just wasn't for me. You've got like, you know, press X for doubt, you know, like, I don't think you really tried, first of all. And second of all, something tells me that your experience with Android is probably like 6 years out of date. So I'm bringing this stuff up, and all the time he's insulting my opinions, like, Juan, you're just complaining to complain, and you're being dramatic. And you're like, I'm going to talk to you the way that you're talking to me. And as soon as I called him out on it, he blocked me. He's like, I don't want to argue. Block. And you're like, I'm not trolling you. I didn't start out this argument, and you're the one saying you don't want to argue with me. So I pointed this out, and then he blocked me. And it's sad, because someone with that much experience, someone who has such a good eye for composition, such an incredible old school photographer from back in the days of shooting on film and getting into digital bodies, that's someone whose eye should be able to translate. That should be one of the people who can bridge the gap between smartphone cameras and traditional standalone and now mirrorless cameras. And instead, he himself is just falling for all of this Apple marketing nonsense. And as soon as I started seeing him front, like, well, if they want to spend $800 on basic point-and-shoot photography, then you can't tell them that's wrong. And you're like, yes, I can. They are being harmed. They are spending way too much. That is not good for them. My grandparents are on fixed incomes. What are you doing? That is terrible advice. So anyway, I'm going to take another drink of coffee here. And I feel that's going to do us for housekeeping this week. Ah. Oh, Aditya, that is very kind. I'm going to read this because Aditya is saying nice things to me. Sorry you had to experience that. It is probably demotivating. You've inspired me to get into mobile photography. You literally made me change the way I see the world. I see colors differently. I look at light and the sun and its various angles differently. You've changed me for the better. Well, thank you for that. I very much appreciate the kind words. The from being an old school audio nerd and... like, I've always had a love of photography. I don't claim to be any kind of expert on optics. But lately, my hobby, my passion, has kind of informed this conversation where I feel we're doing a really bad job of helping bring people into content creation. I think back to the resources that I had when I was just starting... when I was just starting to get into video production, and it was so much clearer, you know, like the path and the technique and how to get involved. I feel like I had better resources for having fewer resources, and there was less sort of clouding or muddying the waters. And now with all of these amazing technological advancements, it seems like it's significantly more difficult to get good data. And you would think, like, hey, if I really want to learn about phone cameras, I've got to talk to a phone techie. But increasingly, I think that's less true. I'm putting this out there because I have found them to be such a wonderful resource and such a wonderful educational resource. They don't cover enough phones, and I wish they would cover more. But when they cover a phone, the guys over at DP Review do a much better job of talking about a phone camera like it's a camera, not like it's a compromised convenience tool that's kind of garbage, but I guess if you have nothing else. They've done the math and the legwork to really say, equivalent, it's going to compare against this kind of camera sensor and this kind of lens, this kind of performance, it gathers light like this, here are some of the raw files, and I wish they would do more. Because I feel that tone of the conversation is what you need to focus on. If you really want to learn more about your phone camera, you shouldn't follow phone techies. There are so very few who are really doing a good, consistent job of rating optics, performance, light, composition, tools, UI, ergonomics. It's not how we talk about phones. We talk about phones like, oh, you should just push the shutter button. Are the colors good? This phone has gooder colors. And that's awful. I'm highlighting specifically DP Review because I think they've done the best, most consistent work at talking about things like equivalent focal length versus equivalent aperture. But anyone who's a more photography-focused individual, talking about a phone camera is going to give you better insight on photography than anyone else who's just reviewing phones. I'm way behind on these. Sore Hunter. That's not true. I'm old too. Old timers don't use digital. They are never changing from film. No, a lot of old folks, myself included, have moved on to digital. I loved shooting film. I have like just this little stack of photos that I shot from a Mamiya medium format film back camera. And they're just stupid, like 20-year-old, oh my gosh, I'm shooting on really expensive film kinds of photos. There's still some of my favorite. I loved shooting on that camera. And again, I am going to be that snob. There's something about the psychology and the preciousness of shooting on film. It really is kind of magic. For real world, practical, like, slice of life, capturing family memories, producing content, I'll never touch film ever again. I don't have the same fondness as an audio nerd. I don't have the same fondness for recording on tape. Oh man, I had to cut tape literally once in my recording career. And the guy who taught me, I mean, he was amazing. He taught me so much about mic technique and just really, really old grizzled recording dude. He had magical ears. Like, I don't understand how his hearing was so good. But he had me like slicing tape, a little wood block and razor blade, and I'm trying to work on this drum track. And he's like, yeah, don't, I know, hard disk and mini disk and DAT and all this stuff, but you trust me, man, tape's never going away. I have never touched tape since. And that was like 20 years ago. I never touched tape ever again. But film, I'm a lot more fond of for photography. Whew, okay, I just kind of fanned myself here a bit. Simon says, Hypno, they've spent years learning their craft and how best to achieve it. Now they have to relearn. And the thing is, I don't think they need to relearn. I think they just need to stay current. The individual that I got into a row with is just out of date. I don't know if anyone was as much of a nerd watching shows like Scrubs, but there was one episode of Scrubs with Dick Van Dyke. And Dick Van Dyke plays this, like, lovable, affable, everyone loves him. He's the doctor that gets along with everybody. But his techniques are way out of date, and they aren't taught anymore. And he inadvertently harms a patient. And it's, again, in the way that Scrubs is a screwball, corny, goofy sitcom, they could have these, like, really heartfelt moments. And it was about putting an old doctor out to pasture, just because he didn't stay current. I kind of feel like a lot of photographers are missing out on a ton of new fun capabilities because of stuff like that, because I feel like they're just not staying current. I'm not saying like everybody has to flip their phones like a gadget reviewer, but if you aren't aware of what's gone on in smartphone cameras over the last 3 years, you are ridiculously out of date on what new optics, processing, raw camera apps have been able to achieve. And so it's not even relearning. You know, it's not like anything needs to change in his technique. All he would get are better tools to fulfill the technique that he's already been working on, especially if he's been shooting as long as I think he has, because you'd be going from like 35 millimeter film to like 16. If you understand those differences in format, sensor size, composition, crop factor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, now phone cameras are competing directly with old tools that we used to rely on. Like, my grandfather used to shoot 8mm. I understand that as a format for framing, composition, and what you can do with light. I remember, you know, running around with that 8mm camera. I have a phone in my pocket that shoots the equivalent of 16mm. And that's the kind of film formats we still produce feature films on today. Like, if you're not aware, you can't contribute to this conversation, you know? You actually do need to know what you're talking about. Sore Hunter, this is a great question. What is the main difference between a camera with a prime and a phone? So a prime lens is a lens that can't zoom. So this is my 16mm f1.4 for micro four thirds. It looks like a big chunky lens, but it is one focal length. So if you want to change the field of view, you just have to walk closer to your subject or walk farther away. You want a wider shot, you got to zoom with your feet. This optically is one set focal length, just like the main camera sensor
on our phones. Our phones only have, well, with the exception of the Xperia, Xperias actually do have moving optical zoom lenses. But our main camera sensors are fixed focal length. They're prime lenses. The main difference is going to be aperture. This can control how much light you let into it. There are little blades inside this lens, and I can squish them down and make a smaller iris for less light to come through. That increases my depth of field, my depth of focus, or I can open those blades and get a shallower depth of focus, depth of field, blurrier backgrounds, and let in more light to reduce my shutter speeds. Smartphones have a fixed, again, with the exception of Sony, smartphones have fixed apertures. So your exposure triangle, where you're trying to balance for your exposure, you've got aperture, ISO, and shutter speed. On a phone, you can only control your shutter speed and your ISO. So that's the main difference. But if you pick up a Xiaomi 12S Ultra, it is very much like you're shooting the equivalent of a 24mm lens at f5. That's a wonderful street photography kind of depth of field. It pops your subject from the background. There is a clear separation between subject and background. It's not so blurry in the background that you lose the sense of your location. And then the sensor itself is very similar to shooting Micro Four Thirds. So right now, I'm shooting this on a 20 megapixel Micro Four Thirds camera, and if I cut that down to 12 megapixels, that's about the sensor size you would have in the Xiaomi 12S Ultra. The pixel size is really close. So the actual photo sites that gather light are neck and neck with a $1,000, $2,000 Micro Four Thirds camera body. But again, if we don't properly inform consumers, there's no way they're going to know that that's what's going on with their phones. So TED Talks Tech, the newest fad is to shoot 8mm film, but at $40 a roll, more power to them. So if you're just talking about, like, I own a DSLR and I shoot, you know, my own little movies and stuff, and I own my gear, if you really break down the prices on things like cinema cameras, rental houses, shooting 16 is actually more cost effective than people think it is. Like if you don't own a camera and you're renting one as part of like a package, even with the film processing costs, you can get your film roll and your camera rental often cheaper than a really nice digital back sensor cinema grade camera. Again, the math is weird. And you've got to kind of plan out, like, what is the whole cost of my cinema project? But 16 looks really interesting, and you can do very interesting things with the look of 16mm film. And if it's a professional film, like it's a professional narrative that you're trying to capture, like, 16 pricing isn't really a deal breaker. So anyway, That's neither here nor there. We went a half hour on housekeeping. So, oh no, Barry, what did you do? Sorry, Juan and Chatters. I made some people mad about the ongoing iPhone 14 bugs. The Apple people were tweeting that they are not bugs, but it's not as bad as the Pixel 6 Pro launch. Well, be careful, Barry. Because you've talked about early software, you too could be blacklisted by Apple, just like John Redinger was. So if you want to make more money on YouTube, you can only say nice things about Apple, or Apple will make sure you have less access to their products. It's kind of the way that you succeed. If you want to be better at YouTube, then you can't ever have criticisms for major companies. The bigger companies will punitively affect your ability to make money. So, we all got to kind of bury our heads in the sand and ignore that iPhones ever have bugs or problems or anything like that. We can never talk about that. That's different. But again, it's like, you know, 60 hertz on an iPhone is like 120 hertz on an Android. So bugs on an iPhone are really like features compared to Android. You're never going to win. They're always going to move the goalposts around on you so that psychologically they can always feel better about their purchase. let's get this out of the way here. Okay, so, yes, that was housekeeping. Housekeeping and like, camera photography 101. Again, I just feel it was so weird to have this, like, professional photographer and someone that I've genuinely followed for a good chunk of my online career. And you're like, he's trying to throw these bona fides, like, he's so much more learned than I am. And over all of the haters and complainers, but at the same time, like, is the one who's vocally continuing this argument. I kept like, hey, man, you know, my silly little photography book was actually course material at Georgetown for a couple semesters. Like, I don't have 40 years of experience in photography. I only have 20. But something tells me I'm hanging with what you're capable of doing. Yeah, it's good times. Dave Burns, so we're going to do a 3-hour show today, probably to 2.5. I don't know how well my voice is going to hold out, but that's the perfect segue. It's the perfect transition. All of the articles, the show notes, the housekeeping, every link that we've been talking about and will talk about, that's going to be available on this week's blog post for the podcast, somegadgetguide.com. Just look up episode 267. You'll get all the links right there. Of course, always appreciate the folks that are rating and reviewing podcasts, whatever podcasting service that you prefer. Saying some kind words, throwing some stars, you know, the effort is always greatly appreciated. And of course, there's the ad-free version and the bumper-free version of the podcast on patreon.com/somegadgetguy. So we've got some legal shenanigans to cover, and I want to bookend these two stories back-to-back and then kind of talk about the ramifications of each. We have a really serious showdown happening at the state level here in the United States for what are the responsibilities of social media platforms and how do we stem the tide of misinformation. I've been talking about bad information being weaponized for about 3 years now. I remember those stories where, you know, 5G towers were getting torched in the UK because of misinformation, and that was before the pandemic. That was before the COVID outbreak. And so we're struggling. We still haven't found great solutions for managing speech that is on purpose incorrect and designed to destabilize a community, be it a city, state, country, a collection of like-minded individuals. The smaller the group, it seems the easier it is to infiltrate that group on online forums and sort of pervert that group with bad information. So, Texas, an appeals court upholds Texas law regulating social media moderation. The decision could set up a Supreme Court showdown over the future of online speech. This is an article from the Washington Post written up by Kat Zakrzewski. I have mispronounced your last name, Kat, and I apologize. U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit on Friday upheld a controversial Texas social media law that bars companies from removing posts based on a person's political ideology, overturning a lower court's decision to block the law and likely setting up a Supreme Court showdown over the future of online speech. So we're not too surprised by that. Seems Texan politicians are all about spreading misinformation and bad data. On the flip side, we have a new bill signed in California. After a 2-year fight, Governor Newsom signs landmark social media transparency bill. The new law will require social media companies to pull back the curtain and publicly disclose content moderation policies, enable greater public accountability for social media platforms that promote hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. And this is an official write-up from just a press release from, it's from Dan Alpert, asm.ca.gov. He's a legislative communications assistant in California. But I do want to highlight that this bill, Assembly Bill 587, if anyone wants to look it up and read it, I believe if a company is found in violation of AB 587, they can face fines up to $15,000 a day. I can't find in this write-up where that is actually detailed, so I might need to add another link to the show notes that for other people that have kind of broken down this bill. So what we have are two state laws that are now in almost direct conflict with each other. From the Texas perspective, there is this notion of almost libertarian-esque free speech. You should be free to say anything at any time, anywhere, and no one should ever be able to criticize you for it. What I call is the conservative snowflake ideal of free speech. Here in the United States, when it comes to the First Amendment, we've also supported through precedent, not through an outright law, but of course we also know how the conservatives play with precedent. The First Amendment protects you from compelled speech. Compelled speech is the government coming in to say, we want you to say things that you disagree with. We're going to force you to say or publish things you disagree with. So the Texas law runs afoul of the free speech protections granted by the First Amendment in our ability to not say things that we don't want to say. That to me is a very critical free speech protection in the way that none of these companies are owned by the government. They're all private platforms. You sign a terms of service. You are doing business with Twitter and engaging with the platform. Texas is saying Twitter should not be allowed to moderate their content, even if it would do them economic harm. Even if they have to publish things that would harm people, that would hurt people. Spreading COVID misinformation kills people. There is a public harm in weaponizing bad data and forcing a private institution to publish it. And that's what the California bill, in a really ham-fisted way, is trying to untangle. This would be another state law that I don't believe will pass the Supreme Court. There's going to be a showdown over this law, and especially with the current makeup of the court, I think they're going to side with this faux libertarian idea of free speech, meaning free to kill people with speech, as opposed to a private company being able to decide for themselves what they would like to publish on their platform. And this is all going to directly reference and probably start modifying the CDA, the Communications Decency Act, where a lot of these companies get protections for being platforms as opposed to being publishers, but they're trying to kind of have it both ways. We've needed to reform the CDA for years now. But I am very skeptical of the conservative side of this reform when the main thing they seem to be encouraging is purposely spreading bad data to disingenuously participate in online discourse. You know, someone who is out there just for the lulls and is purposely sort of muddying the waters on complicated topics, yeah, they have the right to free speech in that the government can't prosecute them for that, but they don't have the right to have their bad take published on another platform. The platform also has a right to protect themselves, their financial interests, from bad actors, from people that are trying to harm just the structure of the conversation. And this is also a major part of the kind of cyber warfare and PR warfare that's happening globally, from what we've seen from like Russian hackers and trying to influence elections and how Brexit went down. And you can flood. Again, I wrote this letter to the FCC talking about upload and download speeds. You know, it's literally 5 times faster for me to download bad information than it is to upload better information. So we don't have an equal marketplace of ideas. Well, if someone publishes a bad piece of information on Twitter, then it's up to other people to correct it. And you're like, that's not how any of this social conditioning works. And even if it were, someone's ability to consume bad data is grossly unequal to someone else's ability to upload better data and to reach out to those kinds of communities. So we're infesting these small, and we talked about this probably a year ago now, where the method is you go into these tiny little groups on like Facebook, you infiltrate this group, you spread a whole bunch of bad data in a small community, and then by the time you see it getting posted on larger forums and larger networks, all of those people have already been sort of polluted by the bad information. It is substantially more difficult to work that back. So I don't believe the California bill is really going to be directly effective in curtailing that kind of spread, because you have to reach a tipping point of visibility. So by the time we see it, the damage has already been done in all of these smaller pockets of Facebook and Reddit and Twitter. It is very difficult to walk that back, but at least we can try to halt the spread at scale. I don't know that it will be tremendously effective, but we can try. Again, at least the California bill is trying to stop weaponized misinformation. The Texas bill just seems like it's in conservatives' best interest to keep people confused and misinformed. It seems like a bill targeting their own constituents to make sure it's more difficult for them to get good information on complicated topics. And to me, that's just mind-blowing that we're now engaged in a First Amendment conversation, and with a Supreme Court who I don't believe will earnestly consider the conversation of a First Amendment cause. Again, we have not enshrined the protections from compelled speech into our Bill of Rights because we've just set precedent legally. And what we've seen from the Supreme Court is they are perfectly happy as an activist court to untangle all of that precedent. Oh, just because we have a history of protecting these people doesn't mean we're going to enforce that. It should have been enshrined in its own separate amendment, and then we would say it was constitutional. That's not the way we've ever conducted the protections of amendments to our Constitution. This is radically different, and it's a radical upset to how we've always conducted business here in the United States. So, I'm bringing this up because these two bills in direct opposition to each other are two of the largest economies in the United States. California is one of the largest economies in the world. I think we're the sixth largest economy as a state, just us, just California. We are the sixth largest economy on the planet. This is going to have a tremendous impact on how businesses try to do business, how companies try to do business online. We absolutely need to pay attention. I'm not sure at this point that there's much we can do to influence the direction of either of these bills. It's now going to be up to the courts to figure out where we go from here, but we need to be paying attention to what goes down. This is vital to the future of communications and just the fun. I mean, like the media, the technology, how we interact with each other, what we can share, what we can say. This is going to have far-reaching impacts that we can't see today. We don't know what the fallout from either of these bills is going to look like in the future. And if we don't pay attention to it now, we're going to get blindsided when stuff really starts going into effect. So.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
It's very, very, very messy. So let's keep an eye on it. Oh, man. Moving on, another one that we just need to kind of keep an eye on. There was a similar initiative out of DC that totally failed, and I kind of feel this one will too. This is another one. This is from the Attorney General's office here in California. Attorney General Bonta announces lawsuit against Amazon for blocking price competition. I don't believe this has legs. I really don't. In the way that we regulate and manage online commerce, again, if the FTC had any teeth, this wouldn't be an issue. But this California Attorney General is saying Amazon exists as this monopolistic force in online commerce, and that is disrupting our ability to have more fair and competitive pricing. DC tried a similar style of lawsuit, and that was shot down. I kind of feel like this one probably will be too. I think they're all coming at this backwards by saying, well, Amazon is so successful that this is the problem. Instead of looking at like actual consumer harms, Amazon's business practices with their third-party sellers, and the way that companies interact with Amazon, I think is a better sort of sideways tactic to get at very similar type of regulatory reaction. Like, I feel like some of the conversations Elizabeth Warren has had are not as direct, but they're probably more tactical at targeting specific aspects of Amazon's business instead of saying, Amazon's too good. Because then you're also going to lose the war of public opinion. You're going to lose in that court. Oh, wait a minute. If Amazon's like saving me money, though, and I get free shipping, then why are you trying to harm my ability to buy products? And I think you're going to lose there. So that's another one just to keep on keep your eyes on. This is not a law. This is not a bill. This is a legal action. We're suing Amazon. So we should also be just kind of keeping that vaguely on the radar, because it would be interesting to see if there are any teeth in that regulatory response for big tech. Amazon is probably due a market correction. Disney is probably due a market correction. Apple is certainly due a market correction. I'm not sure regulators have the fortitude to really go after these major companies. Just another little interesting bit of news. Almost this entire week basically could have been just Juan talks about Ars Technica stories. It's like my news feed was heavy. Just Ars Technica, Ars Technica, Ars Technica, Ars Technica. I'm really grateful that on some of these Ars Technica linked to like the actual press releases from the governor's office, so that I wasn't just, and here's another Ars Technica. Here's John Brodkin again. So this one actually from Ars Technica. Jonathan Gitlin, Ford gives dealers 2 months to accept new rules or stop selling EVs. We've known for some time that Ford was looking to shake up the way that people buy its EVs in the U.S., moving all its EVs into a new business unit called Model E, with another called Ford Blue that will be responsible for internal combustion vehicles and hybrids. In June, CEO Jim Farley said, "We've got to go non-negotiated price. We've got to go 100% online. There's no inventory. It all goes directly to the customer and 100% remote pickup and delivery," during a presentation to investors. I want this so bad. Oh, I want this current relationship of dealers and markups and pricing and customers getting squeezed. Back in the day, I understand why we set up the dealer model and it helped with competition and pricing. Everything has its cycle, right? You've got old people today complaining about unions when unions have never been at their least powerful. There's an ebb and a flow. And in my lifetime, I still expect to see a surge in union activity, which will then probably start getting abusive and we'll need to look at walking back what power is concentrated in the hands of individuals. this to me is the right time to start eroding some of the power of the dealer relationship. And it's never made me more excited to look at Ford. If Ford can pull this off in the next couple of months and say, this is how we're doing business, this is the relationship we want to have with our customers, get on board or you're going to get rolled over, I would like to find ways of supporting that. I don't know that my next car will be a Ford, but if their EV unit really takes off in the time frame that we're looking at shopping a new car, then I would be very, very interested in taking that Ford on a test drive where I would not have been in years previous. So that's the gig. Twin Folk Tech, I mean, tell me about the mob these days. Twin Folk, as long as the mob doesn't take over the unions, LOL, they will. When you concentrate power in the hands of certain groups, you need to then work to break up that power. Right now, consumers, employees, they don't have the power. We're looking at like entrenched billionaires and mega corporations consolidating power blocks at the top. So we need to break that up and we need to re-examine that. We need to return to collective bargaining as opposed to this right to work nonsense. And within my lifetime, probably when I'm in my 60s or 70s, we'll probably need to look at, oh no, now consolidated blocks of union power are being corrupted and are being utilized in unsavory ways. And then we'll need to look at unbreaking that kind of entrenched power model and going back into a less regulated or union-centric kind of way. This is always the pendulum swing back and forth. So, it doesn't help us to say, well, then maybe organized crime. Yes. And guess what? Organized crime is still operating perfectly well in the current power structures with the kind of entrenched megacorp business model and trickle-down economics that we've been playing with here in the United States that have never proven to benefit people on the ground. So we might as well try and make conditions better for people as opposed to corporations. From Soar Hunter, the dealerships will still have markup power. What Ford is trying to do is control the price by everyone being obliged to show their prices online. The problem is Ford is trying to control all parts of the sales and have no inventory. That will not work in consumers' favor. I feel the conversation shakes up, though, when you put up the pricing online and you have to engage in a customer conversation where that initial shopping burst is being led by Ford as a discussion, and then you go to the dealer and the dealer says, oh yeah, but by the way, we have like a 30% markup. That sours the consumer relationship. So in these states where you can circumvent the current dealer relationship, again, Tesla can sell in some states but can't sell in others. The first step in any part of this process, it's not like tomorrow you undo dealers, because that can't happen legally in most of the states in the United States. But what you can do is set a precedent and set a consumer expectation. And then if the dealer harms that consumer expectation, it looks bad on the dealer. They went in there and they said, hey, Ford said this car is this much. And the dealer goes, oh yeah, it totally is, but we've got to charge you an extra $15,000. And then the customer is going to go, but Ford said. So again, this is about regaining some control of the conversation, and Ford is going to be working directly with customers as the first data point. This is a multi-stepped process. It doesn't just change overnight, but if you don't start somewhere and redefining that consumer interaction and making it more nimble and making it more aggressive and making it more direct, less obfuscated by the way that dealers currently operate, then you get nowhere. And right now, cars are not the kind of luxury products that people enjoy. I am working very aggressively with a couple of e-bike manufacturers, because the next phase, one of the next things that I really want to try and accomplish on my channel, just because it's what our family is literally doing, I want to start turning e-bikes into some of the conversation where tech YouTubers like to kind of flex their Teslas. Like, our next car is going to be an EV, but I am radically trying to adopt a new locomotion strategy where so much more of our daily little commuting and treks is not done in a car, but is done on an e-bike. This is the kind of conversation numerous households and families are trying to have, and many cities are looking at adopting more bike-friendly solutions. And the writing's on the wall for the internal combustion engine vehicle anyway. Now is the right time to disrupt the customer-dealer-manufacturer relationship. And this is going to be a small disruption, but it's a start. This gets us talking about that relationship in a different way and will hopefully benefit consumers in the long run, even though immediately on the current car that you buy today, it's not going to change much. That change is going to happen at a glacial pace because Ford is a massive organization and the dealers have entrenched power at the state level. Aditya, well, you know, two e-bikes, some cardboard and a bit of flex tape, and bada boom, you've got yourself a four-wheeler with questionable safety. You take those scraps home, you got yourself a stew. Oh man, Barry, I wish I knew, man. I'm talking to two different companies. I just covered, I covered that little e-scooter a while back, and then the OneBot. I covered the OneBot bike, and it's such a cute little commute. I mean, like, I love taking that thing just to like the little Vons just down the street. It is shocking how many times you just take for granted, like a mile or 2 mile round trip in your car, and like that's the least efficient way to operate a motor vehicle. And it's not really faster. That's what blows my mind. Like, I'm over here on pedal power with, like, a little, what is it? It's like a 250-watt motor pedal assist. Like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. But I can get to the grocery store and back faster on the bike. I don't know. I've got more work to do on that conversation, but I'm hoping that I can start showing off some road bikes soon. So, yeah, Dave Burns. People don't really grasp the Dave writes, I bike 5 miles to an Aldi and it's the same time as driving. And you're like, it's kind of a nicer ride. You've got open air. It's better for your health. I'm trying not to just like, I'm going to turn my channel into an e-bike channel. But you know, I may have to turn my whole channel into an e-bike channel. Yeah, don't throw out. Don't throw that out. You have a whole bone in that bowl. Add some water, some spices. You got yourself a stew going. Carl Weathers, man. I got to work with Carl Weathers at the talent agency, and he was so cool. You know, like, there were so few people that I got real legit, like, Twitter-pated and starstruck. Carl Weathers is a cool dude, man. Really, really cool dude. I love it. So we've got one more news blog story here, and we can kind of wrap up the first hour. I hate that we have to check in on this news story. I hate that this is occupying as much legal headspace as it is. But Elon Musk and Twitter are still doing things. I'm going to take another drink of water here real quick and clear my throat. There we go. I was going to start talking again and had not unmuted my microphone. Musk filing claims conspiracy among Twitter executives to deceive public. Musk countersuit claims numerous independently sufficient reasons to break the deal. This one written up by John Brodkin at Ars Technica. So basically, Musk is just trying any and every legal tactic to delay and to claim malfeasance on Twitter's part. On Twitter's alleged infringement of intellectual property, Musk wrote, if Twitter's core code is infringing on third parties' intellectual property, then those parties can pursue action against Twitter that would either enjoin Twitter's use of such IP, shutting down Twitter's platform, or pursue enormous damages awards. So basically, now he's saying that there is some part some kind of custom code, some kind of IP theft built into Twitter's platform. He has it on good authority from whistleblowers internal to Twitter that they did some sneaky deals and they're not utilizing IP correctly. And that's, you know what, if that's true, then that needs to be why they break the deal. And if we remember correctly, Elon Musk did not do his due diligence in vetting Twitter as a platform to see if there was any kind of IP theft or malfeasance. So really, I'm not a lawyer. It sounds like to me, it kind of doesn't matter if Twitter did this. The way that Elon Musk structured his acquisition of Twitter, he didn't check it. If you try to buy a house and you just throw money at the seller and you waive your rights for doing inspections, you can't then claim, wait a minute, after I bought this house, I did an inspection and all this stuff was wrong. You waived the inspection. You don't get no backsies, like, oops, didn't mean to. I'm so frustrated with this continuously popping up in my feed, and it just makes Elon Musk, this is such clown shoes. It makes him look dumber by the minute. For someone who's supposed to be so meme-y and on the pulse and edgelordy and one of the most brilliant minds of our generation, the way he did this completely evaporated all the goodwill that he might have built up as an eccentric genius inventor guy. It's a shock. And you can see how desperate he is in trying to weasel out of this. And at some point, we just need to slap him with some big old fines. You did not execute this the way that you said you would. It's going to cost you billions either way. We need to have the justice of a market correction against Elon Musk in the way that he has conducted himself in this entire exchange, the way that he's trying to waste court time, the way that he's trying to sideways slide out of this deal. It's a bad look. And if we don't take him to task for it, then basically what you're saying, I feel like this is reinforced a lot in America, but billionaires get to play by different rules than everybody else. It would be nice if occasionally someone pulled a bad move and then had to face the consequences of it in a public fashion so that we could see some kind of operation of our legal system. It's just so dumb. Simon says, no, maybe the government should loan him more money for his lawyers. Yeah, again, there was another thing. Like, I think it was Starlink is going after more taxpayer-funded credits and stuff. And you're like, yep, that sounds like Elon Musk. This self-made man who is a billionaire because he got hundreds of millions of dollars to start his first businesses and seems to keep making businesses that rely heavily on taxpayer contributions and credits and government contracts, but just can't handle paying taxes himself. He's moving to Texas for the freedom to not pay taxes, but he needs more taxpayer dollars to keep his businesses running. I feel like that's a touch hypocritical. That's maybe not how we should be celebrating some kind of eccentric genius. And instead, we should just say, like, maybe it's not good that we have as many billionaires as we do. Maybe we should have fewer. Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved bringing this up, Simon. Starlink, we are helping out the Ukraine. We're helping out Ukraine. Let me try and read words. Reading words is hard, by the way. Starlink, we are helping out Ukraine to have internet. 2 days later, the U.S. government announces that it's paying for it. Starlink got all the goodwill. They're going to send modems and satellite dishes. That's amazing. And then it was like, no, they didn't gift. It wasn't a contribution. It was a government contract that they got paid for, and United States taxpayers footed that bill. Whew. All right. That's going to do it for the news block. I feel like I recovered pretty well. For a half hour of housekeeping, we got to 10:07 here. Sorry, I was just reading some of these other comments. Did everything go glitchy for anyone else before Juan said, let's try this again? And Dustadore, Juan didn't go glitchy. He was just rebooting. I had to kind of reboot my brain there. Every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no exception, but my subreddit is built to try and help promote other content creators. And especially the mission of this subreddit is to try and share content that we believe deserves more attention. So you can share a video from a major YouTuber, totally fine. But really, the main focus is this content that really should be getting more eyeballs than it currently is. I had a pretty strong week last week. I took the top two spots on reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. The Eco Laptop Hub and the YouPerfect Mini X. But the number three spot was a question posted by, come on, subreddit. There we go. Posted by Individual Donkey 762. Okay. I need advice, help regarding getting a bone conduction headset. Using earbuds really hurts my ears. Over the ear can't really be used while at work, so I was thinking about bone conductor headphones. How loud can they get and the quality? And we got a couple little comments coming back from the original poster from Certified Evil Ted. I see Saeed Ted. He was in there kind of offering some suggestions and looking into some solutions. And this is just a nice quick little chat on an audio solution for someone who has issues wearing in-ear earbuds. And I feel like, again, we can make a product for sort of a broad swath of the population. But then when someone has a specific issue, it is so much more difficult finding good information on a solution for them. And that, to me, is where we really need to be highlighting what competition looks like. And to me, it's why bone conduction has been such an exciting technology, is so many people can't really find a good fit on in-ear earbuds. And, like, the options or the solutions are to, like, get increasingly expensive molded ear tips or to go to an audiologist, and not everyone has the means or the time or the ability to do that. And so bone conduction represents this radical technology to facilitate a different kind of audio interaction. But the cool thing is that bone conduction is kind of a perk for everybody. So the better we make bone conduction, it helps that smaller community out, but it also gets better for everybody else. And that is one of the dreams. That's like the joy of better accessibility. If you make a product and you take into consideration how a smaller minority population might have issues using that tech, and you solve that problem for them, increasingly that makes the product better for everyone else too. So I just wanted to highlight that. We don't get as many of those questions and posts and conversations happening on the subreddit, but when we do, I really appreciate those folks that are on the subreddit and are game to contribute. Again, it's not just get AirPods. There's an answer there, and we've got people that are digging into it to try and find what the solution or what the answer might be, or some alternatives. Ted brought up an alternative to using bone conduction that still might have been the appropriate fit or a good solution for that individual. Again, it's, you want to give them good data, not just, oh, I bought this and it's my favorite, so you need to buy it too because it's the most popular. We can kind of spread that out and look at some other solutions. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. This was actually a stronger week for the subreddit, so I'm hoping that this means that we had some people out there sharing. We got some great submissions. It really was a pretty good week all around. So just to throw out the plea, the call to action, the CTA. We can always use more upvotes. We can always use more sharing. If you would like to help promote content creators that you feel deserve more attention, this is a platform I hope you will consider using. Because otherwise, if you leave it up to YouTube, you're not going to get some of this stuff. I find people on Glowing Rectangles that I would never have found through YouTube recommendations. So, youtube.com/glowingrectangles, not youtube.com, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Oh, I'm so tired. I am not caffeinated enough for this. And Gormlord, this week was my first foray into the subreddit. Gormlord, I'm glad that you were participating. Twinfolk, more updutes. It costs you nothing but a fraction of a moment of your time to click the up arrows on content and help content creators become a little bit more search viable in the process. So, check out the subreddit. It's real good. Getting into the gadget block, I've got one more Ars Technica political story. Technically, this should have been a part of the news block, but we talked about it a while back. Google was appealing one of the largest fines ever fronted by the EU, and I feel deservedly. The EU is upholding a 4.1 billion euro fine for how Google bundles services with Android. So this is, a lot of people are going to go, well, why is this bad? I want my phone to have things and people like Google services. And all of those people are idiots. If the pushback on the conversation is just, but it's the way I like to use my phone, so why is it a problem? This actually drills down. Again, this is a story like I feel we talked about almost 2 years ago. It's that Google could put substantial pressure on manufacturers, both economically and in licensing fees, and could prevent manufacturers from doing things like making forks. So if a company wanted to make like an Amazon tablet-style device and used Android code as part of the base of how that device was going to operate, then they couldn't also make a full Google Play Services Android device. And that is anti-competitive. Google is telling manufacturers what they can and can't do with open source software, open code, and is leveraging enormous economic pressure on those manufacturers. That's really the core of what's happening here. The side impact, the sort of side effect of that is, just like Microsoft bundling Internet Explorer raised the hackles of regulators back in the day, now when you fire up a device, you are presented with options. So Google Play, you can choose additional search services for your device. You can choose additional web browsers for your device. And this is already being implemented in some form or fashion in the EU. This is the way it should be. And now that Google has experienced this regulatory action, we absolutely need to take a look at Apple's relationship with their customers and the ability to choose search and to choose web browsers, streaming services, additional accessories, all of the preloaded apps and services on an iPhone. Now that we did Google, which I believe is correct, and at 4 billion, like, yeah, that's a lot, but it's Google, you know, so if they don't feel the economic impact of this kind of business practice, then they're not really going to change. Now we need to look at Apple's business practices and how we can encourage some kind of choice in iPhone land too. But again, I would like to highlight this. I mentioned this, like I did the Pissed Consumer podcast, and I got a little pushback from someone on Twitter saying, like, I'm being so unfair and critical to Apple. And, you know, people don't seem to mind that Apple is locking them into this ecosystem. And I don't think that matters. Like, I don't care if, an individual user is fine with anti-consumer business practices. I still feel like the business needs to be examined for anti-competitive business practices. But for whatever reason, we're perfectly happy giving Apple years of runway to do whatever they want. Regulators never go after this kind of lock-in to the same degree. Microsoft got tagged hard for including Internet Explorer. Google got tagged hard for what is an anti-competitive business practice in not allowing forked devices to come from manufacturers that also bundle Google Play services. That is absolutely correct. Why aren't we going after Apple? Why is it that we still give Apple this special shelf of consideration? I can't understand. They cause the most problems for repair, for parts, for shipping, distribution. Their products are the most expensive. There are all of these potential consumer harms, and we're sort of just sitting around like, yep, but we got Google. Nailed it. Like, what are we doing? When do we apply any of that same kind of consistent focus to Apple products? I'll never understand. The money has to be crazy in how Apple lobbies, as opposed to, because we know Google spends a lot on lobbying. Apple just seems to be so much more effective at creating that reality distortion field. I'll never get it. I'll never understand. It's hilarious. Dave Burns. Oh man, I can't wait for them to roll out the antitrust legislation. Maximum fine, $1 million. The law was written in 1908. Yeah, twin folk, man. I mean, it's shocking that Google can't figure this out with all of their behavioral modeling and consumer data, but twin folk says Apple has just greased the right palms. Man. Papa Cash, moving the goalposts. There are no goalposts for Apple. So anyway, this looks like it's pretty legit. This probably will cause some price adjustments. Google saying like, well, because we're not bundling these services, now if a company makes this kind of a phone, we have to charge for Google Play services. Could be as much as $40 per phone. That's not going to happen. I mean, it's really not in how like products and services kind of the bill gets passed down the line to consumers. Sure, I guess. So now on like a $200 phone, it might end up being a $250 phone because Google is getting pissy about maps being included in the phone.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people. Producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hello, my name is Martin, and I run the Tech Altar YouTube channel. I talk about tech, obviously, but instead of focusing purely on the devices themselves, I mostly analyze the companies, their business and marketing strategies, as well as the industry trends that shape the gadgets we all love. I studied business, I worked for a couple of tech companies like Oppo in China, for example, and I'm building my own tech startup on the side right now, so I really like talking about these topics. And if you enjoy zooming out and trying to see the bigger picture as well, you can find me by searching for Tech Altar, that's A-L-T-A-R, on YouTube, and you can also come say hi to me on Twitter as well. Thanks, Juan.
One last sort of major story that we're going to kind of have to find the fallout from. I actually have three links up here. One of them is from Ars Technica, but I have to shout out. It is incredible to me that a bunch of PC building overclocking nerds, like the nerdiest of nerdcore, my people, my brethren, the lunchroom table where we would talk about motherboards and C++ and like how to build the better Vampire the Masquerade card deck. It is incredible to me that Gamers Nexus has become such a hard-hitting investigative journalism machine. It's shocking. Like, this dude is all about, like, overclocking CPUs using liquid nitrogen, and yet they are holding their channel up to a higher journalistic standard than many local newsrooms. And their ability to break news is really second to none. If you really care about the details and the particulars of what's going on and some of the investigation surrounding the situation and what's going on, I've been tremendously impressed watching the evolution of Gamers Nexus. And this story is no exception. There's a weird schism happening in the world of PC parts. Enormous factors around enthusiast PCs, from the pandemic and the chip shortage and the silicon shortage and the problems with distribution and manufacturing, into NVIDIA's overvaluing of the crypto market. And recently, Ethereum has changed how Ethereum is a coin, is a blockchain platform at this point. And they've changed how they rate and check their work, moving from proof of work to proof of stake, which is radically curtailing the amount of GPU compute power that blockchain needs to operate. And now we're seeing the fallout of that as GPU prices on the 3000 series RTX cards are plummeting. And then out of nowhere, Gamers Nexus gets the scoop. One of the most respected manufacturers in graphics cards is walking away from NVIDIA, one of the largest manufacturers of graphics card chips, and it looks like they're just going to tank their GPU business. Like, they're not saying, like, we're going to go with Intel and AMD GPUs instead. It just seems like they're just not going to make GPUs anymore because of how bad their relationship got with NVIDIA. It's an insane story. So I will not be able to do justice to this as part of this podcast. Gamers Nexus has a 30-minute video breaking down their conversation with the head of EVGA and looking into the situation as it pertains to NVIDIA. This is probably the best first place to go to have this entire situation broken down. From there, I would recommend checking out Andrew Cunningham's story on Ars Technica, where I feel they do a really good job of just kind of filling in some of the little bits and pieces. Like, I mean, 80%, this is the headline on Ars Technica. GeForce GPUs are 80% of EVGA's revenue, but it's cutting ties with NVIDIA anyway. 80% of the revenue generated by this company comes from these graphics cards. And the relationship between EVGA and NVIDIA has soured so much that they're walking away from that. And then, if you really want to follow it up, you could go to the EVGA forums, where official message from EVGA management, EVGA will not carry the next generation graphics cards. EVGA will continue to support the existing current generation products. EVGA will continue to provide the current generation products. So as long as their stock of 3000 series cards holds out, you can still buy an EVGA. And then once they're out of their supply, no more EVGA GPUs. And that, it blows my mind. Again, there are so many PC builds that I've worked on, and EVGA has just been a part of so many computer systems that I've built and that I've worked on. We had some great sit-downs and conversations with them when I was at Newegg. I just can't fathom. Like, this is such a crazy, unexpected. I think that's what's so shocking about this is just there were no forewarnings. There were no clues that something this major was coming down the pipe. And we're right on the heels of next generation AMD chips, the next generation of Intel chips, the 4000 series GPUs from NVIDIA, probably right around the corner. I'm looking at all of this. I'm really trying to weigh up, like, I really need to build a new workstation, and I want to see if I can get a better performance per watt. I'm not looking at building a more powerful machine than what I currently have. I'd actually like something kind of close to this ballpark, but that will run more efficiently. Kind of like some of the conversations I've been having about phones. Like, you know, it's a Snapdragon 8 Gen 1 or an 8 Plus Gen 1. We're talking about performance per watt. And that is what I really kind of want to hone in on. I mean, it would be nice if my videos rendered a little faster. I want them to render a little faster, but I want them to render a little faster for a lot less power. So we're going to go with that. To have EVGA just walk out is insane. So if you care about PC building, if you care about workstations or gaming PCs, enthusiast builds, DIY, HTPC, whatever it is that kind of you're into, this is going to have an impact on that. EVGA not making these GPUs is one of the most respected names in this component, just gone. Yeah, Dave Burns, I got to keep the office much cooler. When our AC died, I was like, oh no, I can't use my workstation at all. This is not going to be good. That Threadripper on a kilowatt power supply, that's going to be good. That's going to be bad times when the outside temperature is 105 degrees. So yeah, give all of those a read. Give the Gamers Nexus a video a watch at least. And again, just because I want to highlight, it's really good journalism. It's just, again, surprising all the way around. But Gamers Nexus has really become a standout for me in holding the conversation to a higher standard. Instead of just the hot take or the reaction or the whoa, wacky thumbnail, like there's way more informed discussion and commentary coming from a tech YouTuber than we usually see with more mainstream press. And that deserves attention. Watch ads or give them some clicks if you have YouTube Red. Like, support that channel because they're doing really good work. So that's going to kind of wrap us up for all of the news and the links. And we got a good half hour here, and I wanted to spend some time just kind of chatting out the review reactions. I mean, iPhones are finally shipping out to people, and that means iPhone commentary is kind of sucking all the air out of online tech discussions. And, yeah, McCorcoran, I mean, I just said, I completely agree. A Gamers Nexus does more investigative work than most journalism-focused channels and news channels. Yeah, and their ability to follow up and interview. Again, they will send someone out to go press the CEO of a company, and like they actually ask, they almost feel like British journalists, like asking questions. Like they don't let it go until they get kind of a real answer beyond just PR spin. That method, that technique is very hard to develop. You get an answer and you kind of have to move on to your next question, but kind of coming back to get a real answer is very not easy. So anyway, iPhones. I don't want to yuck anyone's yum. And I'm not going to do that. Hey, leave a one in the chat if you're rocking your iPhone 14 Pro and then turn around and like poop all over it just because I don't like Apple business practices. but I do feel like this has become kind of an interesting year in just business and strategy. First off, the iPhone 14, which is kind of their main bread and butter phone. I mean, at once it's a little concerning to see that pre-orders are down, pre-sale numbers aren't looking as healthy. And the iPhone 13 was such a strong seller. Like, I believe for its year, the iPhone 13 represented the top-selling single phone in the world. Someone might need to correct me on that if I have that wrong. But if I remember correctly, digging through like analyst sales and shipping numbers, I believe the iPhone 13 was the most popular single smartphone sold in the world. If it wasn't the iPhone 13, it might have been the iPhone 12. This is a crossroads for Apple, where moving forward, it seems like the number tier is going to be a year behind the Pro tier. I'm the car grin. So CompuCache, that went to the 11 for its time too. And I believe the iPhone 12, the numbered iPhone 12, not the 12 Pro, was also similarly the most popular, the highest selling phone of its generation too. I don't believe the iPhone 14 is going to occupy that same space. I think it's going to be interesting to watch because we've got the split between the 13 mini now coming in at a lower price. We've got the 14 and the 14 Plus, a larger sized iPhone. And I think that's actually going to split some of the sales for iPhone consumers. But at the same time, now we're on an off cycle for the iPhone 14. It's not going to have the same chip as the iPhone 14 Pro. And it's basically just kind of a revised iPhone 13, but with just a tiny bit more GPU compute power, which, to Michael's point, Luke Miami showed that the iPhone 13, the iPhone 13 model, 5 to 7% better battery life than the 14 models. And I don't know how Luke Miami tests battery, but when you add a little bit more GPU compute power, we have to expect that the battery performance is going to take a slight hit. So it is a more powerful device. It isn't going to perform as well. We saw this very clearly with the iPhone 12, but that was never a deal breaker for iOS, remember. The iPhone 12 got miserable battery life. The 5G radios just sucked power to the point the carriers told you to disable them. And the iPhone 12 throttled gameplay way harder than the iPhone 11. So if you only played games for a couple minutes, the iPhone 12 was better. But if you played beyond like 5 minutes, it would throttle, thermal throttle, below the average frame rates of an iPhone 11. But again, that's never a deal breaker for an iPhone. It's okay if Apple uses crummy modems and radios, not a deal breaker. Just keep buying those iPhones. So the iPhone 14 is going to be really interesting. It feels like Apple is looking, in the short-term window, how can they ratchet up even more people to go and buy the more and more and more expensive phones? And at $800, a basic iPhone is not a very good deal. I got into this argument with that old photographer on Twitter. At $800, you're talking about general lifestyle features and consumer experiences that can easily be handled in the $400 to $600 range on Android. If we really say we care about these kinds of features, they're comparable for $200 to $300 less on an Android. That is not an insignificant amount of money. And it really makes me concerned for the kind of marketing. Again, every time I complain about Samsung or every time I complain about Apple, the people who are most apt to get hurt by these kinds of business practices are Apple and Samsung consumers. And now with Apple doing this, we know Samsung is probably going to start looking at, well, how do we do a cost savings year? So we'll do an S23 Ultra, and that'll have the new chip and all of the best cameras and all the coolest tech, but then we'll do an S23, which is basically just the S22 again. But maybe we'll put in an 8 Plus Gen 1 instead of an Exynos. If we can't see that Samsung is just going to thirstily copy everything that Apple does, we're not going to get better products out of Samsung, right? And it would be okay if we were looking at, like, real cost savings devices. Like, do I still have it here on my desk? I might have put it away. Oh, no, wait. I think it's over here. Too many phones. So, like, this is my iQOO Neo 6. Oh, but it's using an older SoC. So this is a $450 phone with a good main camera, okay, ultra-wide, and it's rocking a Snapdragon 870. And it has 256 gig of storage. It's a $450 phone. If I want to climb up to something in the more like $600-ish dollar range, like $600 to $700, man, like a OnePlus 10T. I also have it sitting right here because it was under my my iQOO Neo. But you have the iQOO 9T, Snapdragon 8 Plus Gen 1, 256 gig of storage, triple camera array, as opposed to the iPhone's dual camera array. The V1 Plus co-processor for better photo processing, especially low-light photography. Nice 120 hertz display that people say they care about. Super fast charging. 120-watt charging. This is going to be like a $650 phone in most markets. Whereas the iPhone 14 is going to be even more expensive in most markets than in the United States. And it's just striking to me that when we're talking about the more mainstream device, Apple is saying like $700, $800 is where you should start. You should start just covering the basics at like $800. And I just can't see how that's okay. It doesn't matter if like, oh, but you can get an iPhone SE. Yeah, if you want to get locked into the Apple ecosystem, you can do it for cheap. And you're like, if you use an iPhone SE and you compare it in any way to a Pixel 6a, this phone gets wrecked. The iPhone SE is a terrible option as a daily modern communicator smartphone experience. And the Pixel is kind of like bleeding edge for a mid-ranger. It's $450. So it's a little upsetting because earlier in the year, we went through all these shenanigans. Like, I was just holding up the Pixel 6a. Man, how much of a consumer harm is it to have a phone for $450 that has a 60 hertz display? I mean, there are other phones that have faster displays. Like, you could compare this $450 phone against a $1,000 iPhone, and the screen gets a little bit nicer, a tiny little bit nicer in a way that most people can't even sort of describe. In a way that we can't recommend people buy this inexpensive mid-ranger. And the iPhone 14 has not faced any of those criticisms. I'm really tired of, we compare iPhone against Android when it suits us to have Android lose. But whenever the comparable feature discussion arrives and it doesn't equate into a win for the iPhone, we immediately change the end result so that iPhones aren't really compared because, you know, technically it's its own closed ecosystem. So it doesn't matter if you have all of these amazing features on cheaper phones. You can't compare them to the iPhone price-wise because ecosystem. And we let tech reviewers do this every year. This year, it feels particularly egregious, as we have seen Apple raise prices, not build a substantially newer or better phone, like it's kind of the same phone in the iPhone 14. And then we've been seeing all of those same reviewers who have nothing to criticize Apple for, because if they criticize Apple, they will make less money. If they criticize Apple, Apple will blacklist them. Apple is punitive and tactical in how they manage their online and their media and marketing appearance. Where's any of that criticism? It's so milquetoast. You will never hear someone outright say, this is a deal breaker, do not buy this product. I have major concerns over the consumer interaction, the consumer experience. This is too expensive. It should have been less expensive. But we've got all of the crankiness and all of the ire for a $450, full MSRP, by the way, $450 Pixel 6a. And I'm so frustrated that every conversation about Samsung and Apple has to follow this kind of a pattern. Because if I just say, hey, you know, like, I really like this Pixel 6a, I'll get swarmed in the comments for just being a shill, and Samsungs are better, and you should never recommend anything but an iPhone, and I have iMessage, and it should just work, and I heard it had bugs. But you don't get to hear about iPhone bugs. Because if you talk about iPhone bugs like John Redinger did, you get blacklisted by Apple. So now I have to do this whole song and dance saying, where was the outrage over this feature on an $800 iPhone that we were upset about on a $400 Pixel? And the only thing I can really point to in terms of ecosystem when it comes to Apple in North America is really iMessage. Like, that's about it. Like, that's really the only hook they have left. I mean, sure, if you buy into the Apple App Store and iTunes and you have all your subscriptions, like, all of that is a hook. But most of that can be sort of managed or converted into some kind of Android equivalent. The only thing that seems to hook people and keep them in the iOS market is iMessage, which is not as brutal a lock-in point internationally, where we don't see Apple selling to the same degree. Apple now represents 50% of sales in North America because Americans are too stupid to stop using SMS for everything. So it matters if you're green bubble or blue bubble. That's it. Like, if you compare $450, the Pixel 6a stomps everything that you can buy at Apple at around $450. It's really not. And I mean this genuinely in terms of, like, lifestyle features, software upgrades and improvements, not just, I got a new build of iOS, like the Pixel 6a is getting feature drops. It's actually getting more features than anything I've ever gotten on my iPhone SE. My iPhone SE has only gotten these sort of minor aesthetic changes that I haven't enjoyed on a phone that has a distinct hardware Touch ID sensor. Not as big a benefit with an actual piece of hardware there. So it's just really funny to me that... It's not funny, it's infuriating that we're continuously fronting this marketing discussion for Apple in ways that we would never, ever, ever consistently approach Motorola, Sony, OnePlus, Vivo, Xiaomi, iQOO, Redmi, any of these other brands. And the closest we get is Samsung, which very rarely deserves the praise that Samsung Knights think that they need to deserve. A Twin Folk, Signal is great. I passively have a Telegram account that I very rarely use. I'm often in just DMs on other social media platforms. I mean, it's just silly. It's just silly that we're marketing on Apple's behalf for Apple to make more money because of social bullying. And that seems to be what techies want. We want there to be an entire marketplace of losers so that we can make more money by calling Apple the winner. And the only real criteria we have for that is the it just works-ness of Apple products, which really isn't true. They've been facing significantly more security threats, major zero-day exploits, not properly communicating with their customers as to what's going on with those 0 days and those updates and those patches. The build looks fine, but I'm seeing a number of people having early build and teething pains. iPhone 14 Pro cameras are wigging out. Someone just pink screened. They have an iPhone 14 and it's got a pink screen on it, just like we went through last year. The SEs are still facing flex damage and internal components that pop off the motherboards. And as we transition from the iPhone 14 to the iPhone 14 Pro, another YouTuber who is doing incredibly consistent, fantastic, journalist-grade communication, Hugh Jeffries. This is another video that needs 4 times more audience So Apple is trying to greenwash their product lineup and saying, we've got all these amazing opportunities now and repair programs, and we don't need right-to-repair legislation. And Hugh Jeffries disassembled and reassembled two iPhone 14 Pros, which cost him roughly $3,000 to get both of these phones so he could swap components. And wouldn't you know it, it doesn't seem like the iPhone 14 Pros are any more repairable. In fact, it seems like Apple has gotten even worse with the software locks on their components and serializing the parts. And when he updated iOS 16 to one of the decimal point updates, it broke even more when he tried to replace components with official Apple replacement parts. So there really isn't any better repairability for the iPhone. The back glass is still ridiculously complicated and basically not just glued, but solder locked into the back of the phone, making those repairs even more expensive. We see the battery replacement costs have climbed. It used to be like $70 to replace an iPhone battery. Now it's going to be $100. Everything's gotten worse. The iPhone 14 Pro is a less repairable by design product. And what are we doing? We're sitting here and talking about a stupid notification system with shortcuts to make the notch look a little bit better, but the notch is even worse at cutting into the screen, cutting into content, disrupting gameplay, disrupting videos. This isn't an upgrade. And it makes me frustrated because the camera on the iPhone 14 Pro should be recognized as one of the most significant consumer upgrades for any iPhone we've ever seen. Bigger sensor, quad bear array, this should be better for HDR processing, this should be better for image IQ, should be better for IQ. This should be a bigger deal. But instead, it's like, oh, look at this lonely island on the front of the phone, and it's worse. It's a worse solution than the notch. What are we doing? And I'm so tired of this. Like, I wrote this editorial a couple weeks ago about how much I don't like in-display fingerprint sensors. It's taken us years to get to one in-display that I think is in any way moderately comparable to a good dedicated rear or power button fingerprint sensor. We've gone for years with these slower, more finicky, more complicated, less tactile, worse for muscle memory kinds of solutions. They look kinda neat, but they don't do the job of unlocking your phone better. And now I've got an iPhone with this huge pill cutout, lower on the display than the notch. It's not giving me more screen. That doesn't, having a row of pixels on top of the pill doesn't give you more screen. So instead, they're just crafting all of this silly UI nonsense to try and make it look more interesting, but it's at the top of the screen, which is already sort of the hardest way to interact with the phone, and you're sliding it around in your hand more to accommodate those gestures. It's not better. And if you had just given me an iPhone 13 Pro and you had put on the larger camera bump on the back to give me that bigger main sensor. The main sensor is closing in on, it's I think ever so slightly bigger than the main sensor on a Note 22. So I think we go from a 1 over 1.33 to a 1 over 1.29 inch sensor. So just that tiny fraction bigger than a 1 over 1.3 inch sensor. Sorry, math. Fractions! that's huge. That's great. I'm still going to pick up a Vivo, but if you're really into iPhone photography, you just got a substantial upgrade to the optics, to the depth of field, to the focus fall off, what makes a video or a photo look more photographic, more interesting. That should be a huge deal. Apple's post-processing sucks so bad. And we're seeing all of that oil painting effect. We're seeing their noise reduction completely off the hinges. They have not retrained their software for this new sensor at all. Their algorithms for post-processing are terrible. So while I had some concerns with the Pixel 6 Pro, Google spruced up the Pixel 6 Pro crazy fast. We're now on our third generation of iPhones with bigger sensors, and we're still complaining about the same crap post-processing for HDR. And I've got a bunch of stands. Like, but Apple could make it better. Yeah, but they haven't. But now the iPhone comes in purple. Ooh. I wonder, do I still have it on my shelf? I'm going to walk away from the camera, but for the audio people, you're not going to have any disruption to this commentary as I dig through my bookcase, because I used to have... I think I still do. So if we're going to talk about purple, flashbacks to the Michael Keaton Batman and Vicky Vale talking to the Joker, I still don't think purple has ever been done better than on this phone here, which is the OnePlus 6T in Thunder Purple. Actually, can I get it right on camera? I don't know if my... there it focuses. As this purple to black gradient with kind of an S-curve shape to the glass. Oh, this is still, I think, one of the sexiest phones ever made, this OnePlus 6T. And if you want to play with design and color and sort of like what that represents, man, we've had so many really fun phones to showcase that stuff with. Some of those Honor phones with like the laser light kind of etching and cuts, the Honor 8. I'm trying to think of what some other standouts, like definitely the Huawei's, like the old P series, especially when they were doing like all the Pantone colors. Man, those were beautiful phones. And so an iPhone comes out in kind of a weak, sort of faded purple, and it's like, that's the only thing we can talk about. Like, smartphone reviewing has descended to basically just, like, purse shopping. And if you're into that, fine. I can't make videos for that. But I'm looking at people putting, like, real work into testing performance and looking at battery life and comparing cameras, and then someone else is like, I've got the prettiest case for my iPhone, and that video has like an extra 100,000 views on it. We are not talking about tech, we're talking about fashion. And tech is kind of the worst place to make fast fashion. That's what we're doing to our phones, is like, this is going to show up at like a Buffalo Exchange in 6 months at reduced prices. Yeah, purple to black, man. That OnePlus 6T, still easily one of the most beautiful phones ever made. And the blues that OnePlus used later, like on the OnePlus 7 Pro, that blue was stunning. And that kind of matte finish, kind of a satin feel to it. Just don't make them like they used to. I miss it so much. Again, it's like why it's so refreshing. Like, I've got the Xiaomi 12S Ultra here, and I need more people on the Patreon to make fun of me, as in my review on the 12S Ultra on patreon.com/somegadgetguy, I mentioned how the back is this faux vegan leather, and I hate that I have to say this feels so much nicer in the hand. Feels really nice in the hand. You know, like, they didn't make this out of rusted rebar and broken shards of glass and rusted razor blades. It drives me crazy that there are so few options for real competition that one phone with a vegan leather back stands out so much. It's like, what are we doing? Why have we let this market get so stuck in this one idea of how all this stuff should work? It kills me. So I was lurking in the iPhone subreddit and I couldn't wade in. I've been talking about camera tech. I was in our cameras and our iPhone for the week leading up to the iPhone launch, and just trying to kind of join a conversation, because iPhone consumers are like 4 years behind. We've been doing larger pixel binning sensors and going through the evolutionary teething pains since the Honor View 10 and the OnePlus 7 Pro, that era of phones. And you're like, if you don't know what any of that stuff means, this is kind of a shock to the iPhone camera hardware. This is something really different, and it can be utilized to much better effect. I don't think Apple has the skill. I don't think they've got the engineers or the talent right now to really get the best benefits out of the sensor. But if you're shooting RAW and if you're shooting video, this can still be a considerable perk over previous years of iPhone. So I've been trying. I jump into a conversation and say, like, hey, you can look at these kinds of this kind of lens behavior. You can look at these kinds of specs and stats. We have phones like the Note 22. We have the Vivo. We have the Sony Pro I. You should expect this kind of change in performance. And so much of the tech conversation is horrifically ill-equipped to really discuss what you should be able to see for those changes. Like, I'm watching people say, like, well, I'm going to stick with my iPhone 13 Pro because there aren't any differences in the camera performance. And you're like, all you're looking at is the dumbest part of the HDR processing. How can you not see the differences in optical characteristics? How is Apple this bad at it that they're not really drawing any additional low light performance out of this camera hardware? Because let me tell you, if I put this up against like a Vivo, the Vivo on that sensor size with the V1 Plus coprocessor is one of the most formidable low light cameras I've ever used on any product. Not on a smartphone. I mean, opposite my nicer standalone mirrorless cameras. What I can do handheld on a Vivo shames $3,000 full-frame camera bodies in camera. If I want to take the time to lug out flashes and tripods and set up bracketed shots and take those shots and put them into my workstation and edit in Photoshop and stack in Affinity and tone map and HDR and composite and then produce a TIFF that then I can go into a layered program and edit and pop out a JPEG, then there's a tactical advantage to shooting on a mirrorless camera. Or I can pull a Vivo out of my pocket, push a button in night mode, have it scan the scene for me, and deliver a stacked DNG, which is going to edit really well without me having to do any of that merging or compositing. And now Apple's like, oh, but we can do 48 megapixels. And you're like, you've completely missed it. And you've got an army of sycophant reviewers who are not educating your audience. And I don't want to have to be the guy to go in and defend an iPhone. That's not my job. I'm not the guy for that. It kills me. It really makes me sad because you've got all these consumers who are going to spend way more money than they should. They're grossly overbuying on this gear, and they're not really being helped. They're not really being shown, like, what else can you do with it? I'm talking to old photographers who still shoot on phones like their phones. Instead of saying, this is a camera, and this is what you can do with it. And it really is a bummer. Because then we try and make that a comparison point. And when we mention, like, hey, there are Androids that have been competing phenomenally well and offering benefits, well, those perks don't matter. No, it doesn't matter if a Google has great call screening and has better cameras and has one of the best telephoto sensors that's ever been put on a phone and can shoot this gorgeous video now and all these other features. It's going to be green bubble. So it's the second you can point to something that iPhone users say they care about but is not an advantage of the iPhone, they immediately backpedal and say, well, that doesn't really matter. Average consumers don't care about things like that. I don't know about y'all, but I've been watching these iPhone 14 Pro reviews, and a number of them have started calling out that if you want better photo clarity, less oil painting, splotchiness, better color reproduction, and the ability to edit, well, wouldn't you know, if you shoot on your iPhone in Pro and capture in Pro Raw, and you capture a RAW file, the image quality's better. I've been saying for years that shooting RAW on smartphones can be an advantage when you have certain situations. And I've been met time and time again by these numbnuts reviewers, but you shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to shoot in RAW to get good photos. It should just work. How come they can't make it just work? LG phones. I mean, you can get a better photo in RAW and then edit it, but it should just work. What about the auto mode? What about the HDR? What about the average consumers? And now I'm watching YouTubers who spend way more on cinema-grade cameras to shoot their fancy cinematic B-roll, now pointing out, well, you know, if you don't like the terrible, the amazingly bad JPEG processing on the iPhone, well, you can just shoot a RAW file. Isn't that nifty? I've completely changed my mind through the pure meritocracy of Apple. They're just so magnanimous in giving me the features that I need that I never said you needed when it was on an Android. I told you you should not have those features when Apple didn't have them. And now that Apple has those features, now you need them. And we never push back. We never really call that out. Instead, what that does is it just creates outrage traffic, right? The few people like me who do care are like, well, I can't believe this YouTuber said this thing. Check out his review. And then he's like, well, you're just giving him more views. You're just giving him more comments, more interaction. And YouTube's going to say, well, this guy gets views. We need to make sure he's higher up in the search algorithms. And we all get screwed. All of our products get worse because this is the way that we talk about tech. And it's horrific. Yeah, Dave Burns, I can get behind vegan leather being the next fashion flex. There have been a few phones recently that have kind of played with that material. This is the first I've gotten to play with in a while. And it's nice. I hate that I'm going to say, like, it feels nice in the hand. It's really pretty sweet.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
I got a drinking problem. You guys all just watched me fail to drink out of my... This is a different coffee mug than what I usually use, which is why I'm not able to drink water out of it. Steel's finest. I mean, like, there's a feeling of this, right? Saying, I truly believe that phone manufacturers have given up on design in favor of allowing the skin brands to take over creativity. And there's so much of that, like, well, you're just going to put a case on it. Because, yeah, they've built these fragile, incomplete devices. Like, glass is a stupid material to build the back of a phone out of. But more than that, if they were really going to live up to that, I wish they would stop redesigning the outer shell. Make a shell with the idea of it being like 3 to 5 years. And that way case manufacturers, accessory manufacturers, people who cut vinyl skins, make docks and mounts and tripods, all of that stuff would have an easier time supporting your product if they knew, hey, we can make this one case and then maybe just tiny alterations, or maybe not even that. Like, maybe it could just go for 3 years. Like, I have an iPhone SE in front of me and it's got a case on it that was designed for the iPhone 8. But I believe it would also fit in a case designed for the iPhone 7. I'm fine with recycling if you go out of your way to say, like, this is the benefit. We're not going to change just for change's sake. We'll change when technology dictates that we need a new form factor. And instead, keep your cases, keep your mounts, keep your skins. It's all going to still work. Oh, Sore Hunter. 64 megapixels and not using it for 8K? What's the point? For bragging rights? And again, it's hilarious because I've had so many conversations now veering through our cameras and our iPhone. Like, they don't know what that means when you say the iPhone has a 48 megapixel sensor. They're just completely not aware. They've never needed to be. It's never been something they've ever needed to concern themselves with. And they've been told by all of these pants-on-head silly influencers that different camera hardware doesn't bring any benefit. But now that the iPhone has it, now it's magic and perfect and it's what you need. Your old phone is garbage now because the new iPhone has a feature that we've been playing with for years on Android. Oh, yeah, McCorcoran. Some journalists are trying to pretend the iPhone 14 is more repairable because it has some more modular parts, but all of that is moot if it's software blocked, even when you're using original iPhone 14 parts. Absolutely accurate. Definitely watch this video from Hugh Jeffries titled iPhone 14 Pro Programmed to Reject Repair. That's the title of the video. iPhone 14 Pro Programmed to Reject Repair from Hugh Jeffries. He has done phenomenal work consistently showing this pattern of behavior. Apple deserves zero credit for instituting these repair programs that are not consumer friendly. The iPhone is not more repairable. In many ways, it is less repairable than previous iPhones. Their marketing is not truth. And let me just kind of wrap up. Kappa Cash, but it feels really nice in the hand. Oh, Sore Hunter, absolutely. And again, I think we've missed on so many premium materials. Sore Hunter writes, give me plastic and replaceable batteries. What I really want, this is what I really, 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 really want. Tell me what I want, what I really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. So I'm going to hold up my Pixel 6 as kind of like an example here. Again, as a phone that I think doesn't do this. So we've got this phone. We used to have phones like the LG V10. The V10 had stainless steel rails on the sides of the phone. I want a phone that's sealed. It's locked up, but it's built on those rails on the sides of the phone. We used to have this a little bit more with Windows phones. You would take out two little screws by the micro USB port, and then basically the guts of the phone would just kind of plop out of the polycarb shell. And there were some little gaskets and things, like you'd kind of have to get in there and pick and pry, but it was immediately accessible. You couldn't just peel off the back and take out the battery and put in a new battery, but to do any kind of repair, replacement, or battery swap, two little screws. I want the best of both worlds. I want a phone that is sealed up, has proper gaskets, and is better water resistant, but I want it to be immediately consumer accessible if a part like the battery is starting to degrade. I just want a couple little screws to pick apart like some snaps, and then I'd probably have to replace that gasket. Like, I'd have to get a new sticky gasket, but I want the whole phone on like those kinds of rails. Or you take out a couple screws and you peel out the gasket and the screen can pop out of the assembly from the rear of the case. There's no reason why we couldn't make a phone like that. It might be a little bit chunkier, but that would really just be additional incentive to give us bigger batteries. Right now, this whole like glued shut glass on glass sandwich isn't better. It's not better. It just looks a little fancier. So we could go to polycarbs, we could go to carbon fibers, we could go to any number of exotic materials, we could do vegan leather, we could go back to aluminum backplates, maybe use that as a better heat sink. There are so many fancy premium ways to build a phone, and this like glued shut glass sandwich design ain't it? Like, it's not better. It's really frustrating. From Pakostin, but one, 128 gigabytes and shooting raw. Oh, the humanities of transferring all that data so often, especially on Lightning connector, where the iPhone 14 Pro is still using USB 2 speeds. Why? Why are we pretending that that's a thing, right? Oh, you can shoot cinematic video in 4K and better. You can shoot ProRes and then transfer it over USB 2? Nah. No, I'm good. Thanks. Literally any like mid-range Android phone with like a good USB 3 port is probably going to be a better solution, even if the video isn't as good as the iPhone video. I've had so few people be able to break down to me, what is it about iPhone video that you prefer? When you shoot these kinds of comparisons and you're really trying to do like for like, what is it? Is it that little bit of better like HDR compositing so it looks like it has better dynamic range? Is that it? Because I don't see where iPhones have had any real clear tactical advantage for video. They can typically shoot longer files. So I would totally believe that, like, especially like an iPhone 11 would shoot a longer stretch of 4K 30 than most of our modern Androids. Like, I bet you a Sony would give me a thermal warning shooting 4K 30 way before an iPhone would. But I'd still take the Sony video. Like, it's still better. It's better to grade. It's better to edit. It's the better video for working in a project like that. So if it's just like consumer point-and-shoot video, what's the advantage? I haven't seen it yet. I can shoot 4K 120 on a OnePlus 9, and in short bursts, that is some of the most beautiful slow motion footage you can use for your like family videos. It's stunning. And it's stunning on a phone that was released in 2011, at the beginning of 2011. It looks way better than anything an iPhone can shoot natively. Oh, but you can use a third-party app to get more features. Well, then what advantage do you have in using an iPhone? What's the perk? Because I can use third-party apps on my Androids to control the camera too. Filmic is still on Android also. You know, like, we couldn't make the goalposts more mobile if we tried. These are like modular, compartmentalized, you know, helicopter goalposts. So you can fly through the stadium, moving the goalposts at rapid speeds to make sure that your iPhone never has to lose. Barry Johnson. But Juan, iPhone megapixels is simply better. He should, of all smash other phones, have achieved perfection. You know, I bet you iPhone pixels at 60 hertz look better than Android camera pixels at 120 hertz. So that's probably it, is the pixels are hertz. The pixels hertz more on iPhones. Oh, Destadore. I should maybe try and dig one up. The Samsung Captivate is one of my favorite phone designs. That was a lockable metal plate design. Was that the AT&T variant? Is that the one that we got here in the United States? The original Galaxy S1. So instead of that really nasty plastic peeling back, you'd get those like plastic tabs that would kind of snap open. It sounded really gross. The Captivate had like two metal pins, and it was a metal backplate with like a switch that locked it into place. That phone was stunning. That was a gorgeous phone. Dave Burns, Juan, you're just being overly critical. Apple would give us USB 3, but they're waiting to make sure it's the right time to give users USB 3. Again, old photographer dude, like, I think you're just complaining to be dramatic. Okay, boomer. Giapico. Okay, so I mean, like, I agree and I disagree. Giapico writes, their videos look great and so shiny on that tiny screen, but they look horrible everywhere else. But hey, I actually think iPhone video looks good on a larger display. I just genuinely haven't seen where it looks any better. It looks different. There is a difference in how Apple processes HDR in that kind of higher dynamic range. Like, you can tell an iPhone is definitely doing more of that frame. What do you call that? It's like, it's not that it's shooting extra frames, but it's doing like an additional sort of composite or color compression per finished frame to achieve the look of a wider dynamic range. I don't really know what that's called. I'm good with cameras and optics and lenses. I don't know what that processing is called. I need someone to kind of better explain that to me who isn't just an Apple shill, because like, I understand that that looks different, but that's also a kind of color compression that's baked into the video file, which means you can't really grade or edit it. And especially the way that the iPhone can hijack third-party apps for things like exposure values, it won't completely lock ISO or completely lock your shutter speed. The camera firmware gets in the way of you using third-party apps to have a flatter color profile. So you got to shoot Apple's ProRes if you want that real wider dynamic range to edit and grade. If you're just shooting like off-the-cuff point-and-shoot video, again, why would you spend $800 on that? Why is that a basic, nice feature for consumer point-and-shoot at the price of $800? I'll take a Pixel. Pixel's going to be better. It's going to be better at $450. See, Kapakash, and I've seen this said too, the night video looks better on the iPhone. I don't know how many consumers do that, though. And in what way? Like, with a Vivo, I can do super bright 1080p night mode style video, or I can do larger sensor 4K, like 30, and that looks stunning. The lens coatings are better, so you get less of those really distracting lens flares like the iPhone still produces. Like, in what way is it better? Is it less noisy? Because that's not necessarily better, because that's just smearing detail, especially at lower frame rates. You're not really getting better focus or clarity. You're just getting less noise. Noise isn't a deal breaker in low light photography and low light video. It can actually add a lot to your project to have better information, better data, and better clarity on your subject. And then I go and pull out like a Xiaomi 12S Ultra. Optically, is some of the best video I've ever seen, again, from any camera in low light situations, let alone from a phone. So what? I'm not picking on people here when they say, well, the iPhone does better video for this. That's not the answer. That's the claim. So what is the data that supports the claim? What about iPhone video looks better at night? Because it's not the lenses. I think Samsung and Vivo have Apple beat on lens coatings. It's not the sensors. Maybe on the iPhone 14, because now it has a 1 over 1.3 inch sensor. Now it's optically comparable to an S or a Note 22. But what is it? Is it just this kind of HDR style processing? But that means we're going to be crushing more shadow information. And according to YouTubers, when like an Android crushes the shadows, oh, those blacks are crushed. That's supposedly a bad thing. But if we're talking about like the contrast or shadow lifting, then that's processing. And as I've seen talking about night modes, if it's an Android, I hate processed photos. I think night photos should be dark. Processing bad. So what is it? I need some description or some data or some analysis where it's not just the claim iPhones have better video. That's the claim, but what is the evidence to support the claim? And that's, I've never been able to get those kinds of clear delineating examples, and especially from people that are good at shooting carefully to match those differences. I'm so tired of these, like, well, I shot side by side and these are two videos in portrait mode and you can totally tell by the colors that the iPhone has the better color. And you're like, but that's not, you didn't frame the same shots. we were complaining. Barry can attest to this. We were complaining about camera comparisons. There was a camera comparison with like a Note 22, an iPhone 13 Pro, and the new Xiaomi 12S Ultra. And like, we're pretty sure they weren't using the same camera sensors to line up some of their comparison shots. Like, I'm almost positive they shot ultra wide from the iPhone to compare against the telephoto on the Xiaomi. Like, it's not even oranges to oranges. It's like you're comparing like cars against ham sandwiches. Which one is the better solution for reading comic books? A 4x4 or a ham and turkey club? Like, that's the level of mismatch that they're trying to show here. But they're still making the same truisms. They're still saying the same claims. Everybody knows iPhone cameras are the best. Then show us comparable data that can verify that claim. Because just making the claim because Apple marketing said so is not good data. Apple told us that this was the betterest camera. Okay, shoot with it. Show me. Do something that can verify that claim and that we can compare, because I'm not seeing it in real world performance. I'm seeing it in a couple of like very strategic and specific examples of things like video runtime, but that's not the benchmark of a better camera. That doesn't mean I'm going to pick up that phone because I can shoot more garbage content. That's not what I'm going to want to capture my family memories or to produce my projects. I'm telling you, the Vivo and the Xiaomi are almost exclusively being used for most of my B-roll. Even in-office B-roll on my videos now, they're faster, they're more accessible, it's easier to transfer the footage and the content, especially when I'm on Wi-Fi. And optically, they're not far off from me using my Micro Four Thirds cameras. I'm only using my Lumix in very specific shots that require a type of lens and sensor combination that I can't achieve from my Xiaomi. That's where we're at. And I can't do any of that on an iPhone. Like, I literally cannot do on an iPhone what I can do on my 12S Ultra. So I do need to shout this out. This is absolutely incredible. Thank you so much. One Mr. TK Bay, TK My Bay, hashtag, not only subbing himself, but also gifting tier one subs to Farhan, to Dimitri, Treats Milk 2, and Hey Yous the Individual, and Cigar 2. Rocking my socks, buddy. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. He's my co-host on Best of Our Week, but I mean, that means a lot that you're also jumping in here and supporting the live stream and this kind of content. So everybody also needs to be watching everything that TK puts out. And we'll be producing some videos together very, very soon on some stuff. So we'll see. From Barry Johnson, since the goalposts have been moved so much they've disappeared, let's just say it, it just works. Hashtag Apple. Yeah, Dustadori, the Captivate was the AT&T version of the Galaxy S1. Definitely one of my favorite builds. That removable metal plate back was awesome. From Copacash, but most of the time they're comparing it to a Samsung, not against a Pixel or a Vivo. But even then, I mean, because I'm no great fan of Samsung cameras, and I feel like Vivo and Xiaomi do a better job of that kind of optical performance. A Note 22 is formidable. That is a powerful imaging platform. And when I would show things, like especially like back on the Note 20 Ultra, I was showing like, I don't really love this kind of color processing and what Samsung does to HDR, but if you shoot a RAW file, the image that you capture is stunning, and it's really easy to edit, to tweak, to slap a filter on. I mean, it is such a photographic look. This is back in the 20 series, the S20 Ultra and the Note 20 Ultra, years ago. And now we're getting people saying, well, but I mean, if you want better photos, just shoot Pro Raw. And you're like, I need to just stooge slap the lot of you, just line you up, like take a mannequin hand so I don't hurt my own hand and just... Because again, you would never have given that consideration to an Android. You would never, I mean, this is even me defending a Samsung. You would never have given that consideration to a Samsung. You would have complained about the camera app being too complicated. What is this expert RAW? You've got to hold still and let it process. Processing images is so bad. Why doesn't it just work? And now they're giving all of that goodwill to the iPhone. And again, they're trying to, like, my mind has been magically changed. I had a preconceived notion, but now Apple's shown me the light. And they couldn't even do that for Samsung. It's just super gross. Super gross. From Jay Severino, 123, talking about video, in which situations is it better to show, I think you mean to shoot in log versus shooting in HDR. It really depends. Again, I'm not going to be able to clearly answer this in kind of the few 4 minutes that I'm going to keep us here. We are going to stop in about 5 minutes here. That is a very complicated question. An HDR finished product shot in HDR makes sense in one direction. Log is used more in a situation where you might need to adjust curves and grade color to match other footage. I think, generally, I think it's better to try and shoot log in situations where you might also be working mixed camera. So let's say you're trying to combine footage from a couple different viewpoints, you don't have the exact same camera in every place, or, hey man, I'm shooting a documentary and I've got the second shot, I just need to line it up, let me pop up my phone, throw on Filmic, shoot log, and I can at least capture a B angle that we're not going to cut to very often. But then I can grade that and edit that footage to look more similar to what we shot from our main A camera. Other editors are probably going to have, or probably going to disagree with me, but then also will have more specific reasons for selecting what you do. I shoot very consumer punchy. Most of the time I'm not doing much to color or grade my photo, my videos, and it shows. But really what I'm just trying to do is achieve some sort of less distracting talking to camera. And then if I'm shooting outdoors, it's okay if my shots don't completely line up with what I shoot in my office, because I'm not trying to balance white balance, exposure, you know, the different color curves that we might process. It's a bit more complicated than just, I use HDR when shooting my cat, and I use log when I'm sitting by my swimming pool. It's not easy. It takes technique and it takes experience learning why they're different, so that then you can make the informed decision. This is the tool I need for this, and this is the tool that I need for that. So I'm sorry I couldn't help more. DTNL. I am so happy that Apple invented RAW and DNG files to let me experience the unprocessed beauty of nature. Except that ProRAW is going to get in your way. Now, I had all these people telling me they don't like processed images on my Vivos. Super RAW? That's not real RAW. And I need that same kind of energy on Apple ProRAW, because that is a stacked DNG. That is not a raw image. That is an edited, processed image. It's not finished. You should still edit your Pro Raw, but it's It's not raw. I still think the Vivo does better, especially in low light. So, you know, if you cared about those features, other products do those features better, is what I'm saying. But again, an iPhone reviewer is going to ignore every other advantage of every other product and talk about why you don't need those kinds of features until the iPhone gets a reasonable facsimile, and then they're just going to pretend that the iPhone version of that feature was always the best, which was never true. All right. Well, that's enough crankiness. I'm not going to be reviewing the iPhone 14. I have no plans to pick up an iPhone 14 Pro. If I do, I will only be putting that content on Patreon, but I am not making any promises or any claims that I will be. So don't be on the lookout for my Apple coverage, because it will not exist in any kind of consistent or reliable fashion. I'm having way too much fun on the products and the companies that I currently enjoy working with, and I'm going to stick with stuff that makes me happy to use it, as opposed to stuff that is just going to increasingly make me cranky about global politics and business practices and regulators. There is no benefit to me covering Apple right now, because there's no way for me to separate my personal feelings on the company and the review schism from the actual product itself. And I don't think iPhone consumers want that. I don't think Android consumers want that. And for my own mental health, I don't want that. So I'm not gonna spend time, money, or effort trying to promote Apple so that hopefully one day Apple might like me and I can make more money on YouTube. That's never gonna happen. So I'm not gonna try. I'm not gonna, you know, just play the game a little bit, right? You just gotta, you know, like, just give the YouTube algorithm most of what it wants, and just change your channel into being something that is completely unrecognizable from what you would like to do, and then, you know, that's how you win at social media. So on that note, lots of stuff coming out. Hopefully tomorrow I can finally open part of the embargo on a product that I am really excited to be talking about. It's not a phone. It's not a laptop dock. It's not audio. It does have an audio component, but it's not itself an audio product. Being really cryptic, I'm trying not to break my embargo, but also tease. This is something I'm super stoked to be playing with. And then I'm going to be wrapping up some conversations on the Unihertz Titan Slim, a little keyboard phone. I'm almost done writing a review on the Poco M5, a phone that to me is kind of challenging to talk about with the number of Poco M4s that were released. That's a bit tough. And then, just because I was kind of mentioning it here, there are phones like the OnePlus 10T, from the Pixel 6a to like the OnePlus 10T, there's this $400 to $700 tier of Android that I think is absolutely crushing right now. And one of the examples that I like to point to is the iQOO 9T. So if you're looking for that kind of, especially internationally in the markets where this is sold, if you're looking for that crazy high performance, minimal compromise kind of phone, this is going to be way cheaper than an iPhone 14 and is going to be better in almost every comparable way with hardware features that an iPhone 14 will never have. So I'm going to be writing up just a kind of an after reaction. Like, I did a video on the iQOO 9T. A lot of what I like about the 9T can also go for the OnePlus 10T, but I'm going to have an article, a written article, just kind of revisiting what high-performance Android looks like in the era of 8 plus Gen 1. So lots of stuff. Oh, and I still have the Windows PC, the Geekom. Ah, I completely forgot to mention, the Mini Air 11 came in this really fancy box. And I'm going to be putting together a video on this guy, just a newer 11th Gen. What is this? This is the Intel, this is one of the Celerons. So, but it's the newer 11th gen Celeron, but it comes in like one of the best like fan packages with accessories and cables and like the cute little Nook like casing and stuff. So if you want something that's going to kind of bolt to the back of a monitor, it's just really pretty. So I kind of wanted to do, it might end up just being a short, but I kind of wanted to do just a visual on that, because I wish more companies were making kind of fan edition, not like the way that Samsung does where you get less for the phone, but like you buy this thing and then it comes in like the full kit that you can use to accessorize it. Like the way that OnePlus puts out reviewer hardware is in a nice presentation in box and you got all this stuff in the box. I want that for consumers. And that Mini Air 11 is kind of like that. So, hold on 1 second. My voice is actively failing. I can feel it right in the back of my throat. Hey, folks, have a great week. Tons of content coming out. Tons of people streaming. Tomorrow is Gadget Goddess. Wednesday is Eric Easy Computer Solutions. Thursday is getting real heavy. That lineup is great. I think Michael Peppertech is doing stuff. Ike Talks Tech is doing stuff. Easy usually puts out sort of a podcast or a pre-record. Then TK and I are going to wrap out the evening on Thursday nights with Best of Our Week. Then Friday is Tech Valor. She's now streaming on Fridays. She's really nice. Definitely give Tech Valor one of her live streams a shot. She's kind of filling in the Friday night spot that leads into LaShawn. And I think Viper has also been streaming more on his YouTube channel again. I mean, Viper's been doing such an amazing job of hosting like Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces, those kinds of more forums for conversation. Night and day, man. Viper was always a really fun, high-energy host for his own YouTube channel. His interview and hosting skills are top-notch right now. It's all because of the Clubhouse stuff. His YouTube channel is not getting nearly the attention and love it deserves from the algorithm. YouTube doesn't know what to make of this like bombastic, energetic tech conversation. And it's really sad. Like, it's really frustrating to see. Like, he started up a whole other channel just to kind of reset, start fresh, try and draw that audience. And YouTube, again, is kind of throwing cold water on it. Then Saturday is TK Bay. So definitely check TK's streams. And then when does Sam stream? Is Sam now Sundays mostly? And I think we'll start probably seeing, hopefully we'll start seeing Jeff come back when he's ready. El Jefe Reviews was also Sundays too. Literally every day of the week are some of the best broad tech, fun, enthusiast conversations you can find. This is way better than just if it feels nice in the hand and let me show you a collection of pretty cases. This is like really getting into the daily lifestyle, nitty gritty, pros and cons with some really fun commentary on top of that. So stay tuned for my channel. I've got a bunch of videos and articles coming out, but also make sure you're subscribed to all of these channels as we're catching content throughout the week. And I hope everybody is staying safe. Take care of yourselves so you can take care of others. This collection right here, we're some of the best crew of good tech neighbors and people that I feel consider the advice that they give to others and really do try to live that mission of finding the right fit for the right situation. So please keep up with that, even though you likely don't get the kudos you really deserve. And I will catch you all back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Stay safe. Be well. I'll catch you back. I love you all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take better photos. Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.